sending your kids off to college. Stay with us. I'm excited to be sitting across an author today. Of course, the vast majority of author interviews that I do are over the telephone or via Skype. But today, the author sits across from me in our WGTD studios. His name is Robert Bizat. He lives here in the area, and many of you might know him for various work that he has done in the community. He is someone who has done widespread consulting with literally hundreds of various organizations across the country, nonprofits and corporations and everything you can imagine. He has also taught management in a couple of different respects. And he is the author of a new book called Character-Based Management, A Key to More Productive and Effective Organizations. In this book, Robert Bizat examines some ways in which we can think about basic tenets of management that involve the matter of character versus thinking about management in a way that really tackles only surface behavior. And it's his belief that by thinking about character, managers can do a more comprehensive job of managing their staffs, their personnel, in much more effective ways for the betterment of everyone involved. Again, the book is called Character-Based Management, A Key to More Productive and Effective Organizations. And Robert Bizat, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to be here. Appreciate it.
Maybe you should say a word first of kind of the road that eventually took you here to the area. I think you were saying 7 or 8 years ago. Just sketch for us briefly your professional career and where it has taken you and what role maybe Southeast Wisconsin has played in all the different things you've done.
Well, I'm a Chicago boy originally, still a Bears fan, and gets me into trouble sometimes. But I got involved with local government years ago as a city manager, and I did that up in a city in Minnesota, south of the Twin Cities. Then I eventually helped start a company that did consulting with cities around the country. So I, as Greg mentioned, I've worked with over 300 cities from coast to coast on a variety of different kinds of management issues. And I've also then worked with number of not-for-profits on some of their issues, and I've eventually I own the consulting business, and part of though being an administrator, I was in Mount Pleasant from 85 to 90 as town administrator there. Mm. Then I went back to the consulting business and owned it and sold it a few years ago. So I've seen management from all kinds of perspectives. And I've also taught, as you mentioned, that in fact, I think some of the first courses I taught in supervisory management were for Gateway back in the early 80s. We were living out in the Burlington area at the time, and they had an ad in the paper that they wanted people to teach supervisory and management courses. So I thought, okay, so I did that. And over the years, I've taught some at Marquette and in the Chicago area at some of the universities. And so I've been involved with management one way or another, from either a consultant or a manager myself or as a teacher. I had never seen anything about character related to management. And I was teaching a class at Lewis University in the Chicago area. And it was an introduction to management. And one of the quotes that was in the textbook, which I had never seen before, it said, "In making decisions, the moral character of the decision maker determines the quality of the decisions." And I thought, wow, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. what is he really saying? And it was a quote from a fellow named Henri Fayol, F-A-Y-O-L. He was a Frenchman, actually wrote that about 100 plus years ago, and it was really one of the first management textbooks that were ever written. And so I started looking into it, and that was 10, 12 years ago, but never had a chance to really kind of think about it in the depth that I wanted to. And at the same time, I've seen all kinds of management theories and practices and things that people recommend. And a lot of them have a lot of good things to say about how you manage people. But I've never saw anybody, or never read anything anyway, about character and who you are as a person and how that really impacts the people you manage and the success of the organization, as well as the enjoyment you get from your work.
Hmm. And you were saying that in the book that if someone is trying to amend their management style or trying to improve the management style of somebody else, if you don't involve character, then almost by definition, you're doing it in a rather shallow window dressing kind of way versus a way that digs deeper into why people behave as they do or the reasons people see the world as they do. And that's when we get to this area of character. How are you thinking about the term character in this book and in this context?
It's really who we are. And it's hard to define. We can usually define it's character by things we do and say. But it's really at the core of who we are, and it's made up of what we know, what we believe, how we feel about things, our values, the relationships we establish and continue to have, and I think in many ways the role models that we follow. Those are all things that kind of determine what our character is, but it's just really who we are. And I remember when the One Minute Manager books came out probably 20 years ago, and I thought, well, those are good behaviors that they're describing in there, but if they don't really come from who you are, people know you're a phony. Hmm. And I guess as both an employee before I was a manager and then as a manager myself, people know when they're dealing with somebody who is really believes in what they're doing, believes in them as employees, respects them, and no matter what your behaviors are, if that doesn't come from within whom you are, people know that.
Right. This hadn't occurred to me as I read your book, but it occurs to me now that probably one of the reasons so many organizations and businesses gravitate to some of these other models of management and, again, of the amending or reformation of someone's management style is the fact that there's probably something very easy and direct about, well, just do these four things or do these 10 things. But when you start talking about, in a sense, reshaping your own character, that sounds more like a more formidable task and one that doesn't happen overnight. And so I suppose in some respects, that's a conscious decision that someone has to make, that it's going to be worth the time and the trouble. So how does one maybe persuade somebody that they need to be thinking about something like management on this deep level of character?
Well, I start off the book and even on the back of the book having taught all kinds of supervisory management at universities, at colleges, in workplaces. I just always start by asking people to think of the worst manager they ever had. Mm. And everybody smiles and laughs like you did. And I say, picture him. Just really picture him or her. And then write down two or three things that really made them bad managers. And then we go around the room. Usually there's groups of 15 or something. By the time you go around the room about three times, you got 45 things up on the wall. And they're all based on kind of the behaviors, but the character of the person. Very little has to do with their job knowledge. That might come up once in a while, but it's all issues of behaviors that I think stem from who you are as a person. I ask the opposite question. I say, well, think of the best manager you ever had. And you get not as many terms, but they're always very positive. It's how you relate to people. Do you trust them? Do you respect them? And those kinds of things. And those behaviors, again, you can learn some of them. But they really come, especially when the pressure is on and you have to make decisions either on a time-sensitive basis or just they're very important. You revert to who you really are, I think. And you don't treat people the way some of the behaviors say you should if it doesn't come from within. And people see that. And all you got to do is blow that two or three times with people, and they no longer will trust you, respect you, and they won't contribute to the organization like they really want to. I think people really want to, and I know when I my first job out of college, first couple of jobs, people spend more time moaning about their bosses around the water cooler or the coffee machine, and people had good ideas of how to get things done better, but nobody would listen to them. And so that was just something I thought, when I'm a manager, I'm never going to do that. I want all these people coming to me with their good ideas, and let's get something done.
Absolutely. Let's return for a moment to this Frenchman, Henri Fayol, whose writing was so intriguing to you. And this is, of course, writing from a century ago.
Yes.
First of all, does what he wrote 100 years ago very easily and directly apply, or is he talking about things that need to be slightly reshaped or refocused to be applicable today?
No, I think I got his book. I should have brought it with me. But he talks about many of the things that if you go to MBA program or business management program, the kinds of things that are still studied as far as organizing any kind of a business or any kind of organization. And I think the things he talks about when he talked about the quality of decisions being determined by the character of the decision maker, he never really directly talked about character. He did talk about the behaviors, but the behaviors are still the same. In fact, even on that make you a good manager, but they really come from deep within you. And he has these behaviors spread throughout the thing, throughout the book. And they are the kinds of things when people say, "Who's a good manager that you had?" And I ask those questions of people. That's the kind of things that people come up with. But it really, he didn't say it directly, but I accept to say that the character of the decision maker determines the quality of the decision. And that's another important word there. It's not just making decisions, but the quality of decisions, that those decisions impact the way the whole organization operates.
Right.
Not just productivity at the end, which is really important, but how you get to that point.
Sure. And so he mentions certain characteristics such as equity, dignity, loyalty,
yes,
tact, care for common good, always learning, flexible, foresight. It's actually a great list, and that's just part of it, but various human qualities that, again, spring from a really deep place.
Mm-hmm.
So you devote a whole chapter of your book to where character comes from. Mm-hmm. If somebody demonstrates this kind of admirable character versus somebody that doesn't. And one of the important points you make is that character emerges over the entire span of our lifetime. We're not just out of the womb the person that we're going to be. What are the most important contributing factors to one's character before we even get to the matter of reshaping one's own character consciously? How does our character otherwise get shaped, in a sense, without us even knowing it?
Well, I've mentioned five things. One is knowledge, what we know, our beliefs, our emotions, which I think are deeper things than just feelings, our relationships with people, and the role models that we follow. Those are the five sources that I talk about anyway. And what we know, we learn all the time, but everything we learn isn't true, isn't correct. And I use in my book kind of a continuum of knowledge, from things that maybe we know 100% on one end to things we know nothing about on the other end. And I think in this polarized world we live in today, that's important to look at that, whether you're managing a business or you're involved in anything. There's very few things we know 100%. You know, I know I exist, I know I'm going to die. Those are two things I'm quite sure about. Somebody, I mentioned that to a group I was talking to. They said, you're going to pay taxes, too. I said, yep, that's I'll go with that, too. But on the bottom end, there's so many things I don't know much about. And I use always an example of nematodes, because I don't know anything about nematodes, and I don't know if you do. But as I've did a little research on it, they're basically round worms, and you fish with them, and there's 10,000 different kinds, and they've been here millions of years before us. They'll be here millions of years after us. But there's just so many things I don't know hardly anything about. And then in between, I know some things. So I guess just that knowledge, if we're going to make decisions, we got to know as much about the situation as we can. And so we always need to be learning and learning broadly. And so that's very important. And when we don't know things, we believe things. And I look at belief on a continuum also. And one of the things I, you know, on the far right is of the continuum that is a strong belief is that I'll be alive tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I don't know that for sure. I can drive back home to Mount Pleasant from here, get hit by a truck, and adios, you know. Mm-hmm. And on the bottom end, you know, the believability is that the Martians are coming. You know, there may be extraterrestrial life out there, but we've been up to Mars, looked around, and there doesn't seem to be anything there. And then in between are a lot of things we believe. And sometimes people talk about belief as just something we pull out of the air to make ourselves feel better. But it's really a combination of what we know, but we don't know 100%. So we believe based on other sources of how we experience life and the credibility of who tells us stuff. You know, I had some prostate cancer issues to deal with. I didn't go see Aaron Rodgers, as good as a quarterback he is. He doesn't know anything about that. I went to see somebody who knows more than I do, and hopefully everything's being dealt with satisfactorily. So that belief, again, we act on that. We act on what we know. We act on what we believe. And then we have emotional reactions to things, and they shape a lot of who we are, because those are instinctive in many ways, but they're deeper than that. And I always use the example, if a big lion is charging towards me, my emotional reaction is going to be physical and mental. I got to get the heck out of here, and I'm going to go as fast as I can. And the other side of the coin is, if I see a friend walking down the street towards me, I recognize that, I have knowledge, I have experiences with this person, and my emotional reaction is 100% different. You know, I'm like looking forward to it. I'm smiling. And, you know, so emotions, I've read a lot about it over the years, because I think that drives a lot of our actions as well, particularly from deep down. And then our relationships that we have with people, how deep are they? How solid are they? And then the role models we follow. I've learned so much from so many good people over the years just watching them. I've also learned what not to do by watching them. And so those are the sources, I think. And I'm sure there's more to it than that, but those are things that I've thought about.
So person A, who finds themselves being a manager with management opportunities or responsibilities, but in a sense does not have the kind of character one wants in a manager, not the kind of character from which will spring all of these good decisions and good choices and so on. Your book includes some means by which somebody can, in a sense, strengthen their character. And if I recall, it's in two different channels, in a sense, and one involves the mind and one involves the heart.
Yes.
So talk about that.
Okay. Well, in the mind, we can be learning all the time, and we need to be learning all the time. I've also written another book called Knowing and Loving, The Keys to Real Happiness, and some of the same ideas are in there. But I think the more, the closer we can get to the truth, and it's hard to get to the truth. And I've heard a lot of philosophers say, well, there's no real truth, you know, it's just what you think and I think and so on. But I think there's a reality out there. I think we all maybe see it differently. We come to it with different experiences. But I always want to get as close to the truth as possible so that when I make a choice or a decision, I'm dealing with reality as best I can and not just some things I'm assuming and so on. So I'm always trying to grow my mind, and particularly in ways that are not work-related. So, you know, I read the newspaper every day, a couple of them, really, and I read magazines all the time of all different kinds, because I've found out over the years, the broader your base of knowledge, the better you can help understand what a situation is and then make a better choice. So there's all kinds of ways to learn, and I listen to people all the time. I read books all the time. I write to authors because, to me, that helps me understand what I'm trying to say and what I think they're saying. And interestingly, I hear back from a number of them because nobody ever writes to them. you know, but it's just this whole idea of thinking things through and getting as close to the truth and understanding of a situation as possible. I think you need as broad a base of knowledge that you can bring to it, because there's human aspects, there's scientific aspects. And I talk about the book of integrating things to be a good manager, and that you have to integrate job knowledge, which is things about the product that you have, the personnel, finance, technology, marketing, sales, all those things. You got to know them, and you got to be learning them all the time. But you have to learn process skills. You have to learn about planning and communicating and leading and team building and organizing, reorganizing. And that's what a lot of training is that people get. And that's all good stuff. But I think to really tie that all together and integrate it, you need these other things of continuous learning, so that you're always seeing things as broadly as possible, and you're open to what other people have to say. Particularly one of the things I mentioned in the book is that I heard from somebody years ago, an older manager. He said, you know, the people who do the work every day know better ways to do it if you just give them a chance. I thought, that's really good. That's really interesting. And I found that to be the truth over the years. And part of my job, I always thought as a manager, was to create an environment where people would speak up and we'd be comfortable doing that. And particularly when you got a group of people around you, that helps. So that's just part of it as far as learning. And then your heart, that has a big deal to do with who we are as human beings as well. And I talk about and started writing the chapter, and I said, no, I can't say this, but about love in the workplace. And I said, nah, nobody's going to believe that. That's a bunch of junk. But it's true. We, some of our best friends over the years, we make it work. But part of using the term love is that in our culture, it's very narrow. We talk about physical erotic love. That's love. But love is particularly much broader and deeper than that. It's friendship, it's caring, and so on. So both of those areas, and I just say, particularly with my other book, grow your heart and mind every day. You can do that. You can pick out something every day where you can grow your mind and you can grow your heart. So, again, that's part of it. I can go into more. But
sure. No, you explore a whole lot of things about it. That's kind of the heart and soul of it, is trying to, in a sense, deepen one's sense of character with this understanding that so much comes from it. And then, of course, you get into some nitty-gritty specifics, including kind of the relationship between character and leadership, how that's so essential to being a good leader. But I wanted to circle back to close to a really interesting point you make about, of course, what this whole book is really about, which is management, being a manager. You say something really intriguing at one point about how management is both an art and a science. And I think that's really intriguing. And I love the example that you give, which calls to mind the great painter Pablo Picasso.
Yes.
So say first what you mean by this notion that management is both an art and a science. I think most people would say it's probably just a science. That's how we tend to think of it in those terms.
Yes, and there's a lot of science to it, and it depends on what you're managing and what your products are and all that type of thing. But the real art, and I think the beauty of management and the enjoyment of management, is to look at the art end as well. And Picasso, you mentioned the example when people asked him about great art, you know, and so on. He focused first on getting the right turpentine. You know, that's what the great artists talk about, because you can't create if you don't have the basics and you don't understand what you're working with. But then the art of it is to pull all together all kinds of different things that make something beautiful. if you look at a beautiful picture, you wonder why it's beautiful. And it's beautiful because an artist can bring together all different kinds of elements and create something that's beautiful. And people stop and say, whoa. And I think it's the same in management, that you pull together the knowledge, you pull together skills, process skills, but you pull together the best of everybody. And you create something beautiful, which I think is fun and enjoyable. And one of the things I mentioned in my book that I also talked about here, because it brought together that idea of creating something beautiful and being an art. Somebody said when I was leaving a job and we were having a little get-together, she said, you bring out the best in people, to me. And I thought, holy schmoly. You know, I'd better live up to that.
that's the highest compliment a manager could be given.
Yes, it
and
is.
Of course, you think about all of the instances where I know one of the things you talk about is how many managers who end up not being effective and are not viewed as effective, so often the problem is they make it all about them. Yes. They make any success all about them. And real success doesn't come from just you. It comes from everybody that you're working with, working together, bringing out the best in everybody, because the best of everybody contributes so mightily to whatever that final success is going to be.
Well, you summarized it better than I can. You do this for a living, I can see.
Right. So let's make sure that we give you a chance to talk about Thursday, when you're going to be speaking to the Kenosha West Rotary Club. You're going to be talking about the book?
Yes. And I found Rotary Clubs are a great place to talk to people. I mentioned I had written another book a few years ago, and I've spoken to probably 90 Rotary Clubs in northeastern Illinois and southeastern Wisconsin, because one of their things is they like speakers to come in. Yeah. And one of the things they talk about in their four-way test, the first thing is it the truth? And I think, as I mentioned earlier, and whether it's in our own life or it's in how we manage people, to make good decisions, you got to get as close to the truth as possible. And so this will be the first presentation I'm making on this book to a Rotary Club, but I've got about four or five others lined up. But it's really, again, things are in some ways more complicated, but if you really look at it as creating something beautiful, functioning, effective, productive, it's worth the time and effort. And you got to invest that time and effort. And so when I speak to this group, it's going to be more of a focus on business. But on my website, I just talk about, with my two books, it's the kind of the subtitle is Be a Better You. And the first book was more Be a Better You Personally. This is more Be a Better You Professionally. And I've got an app that goes with it, because nowadays we need reminders. And one of the things I've had over the years, and I still carry around with me, is one of the things I knew to be a better me and be a better manager was to shut up and listen. For me. So I have that little yellow sticker on the front of my calendar.
I see it. It's right there.
And it reminds me every day. And so I came up with 10 things, at least, on this app that you can take a look at. Pick out one that you want to do something this coming week about. And every Monday, it'll send you a reminder. You know, and because I need that. I think we all need that. We are all busy with life. We're busy with families. We're busy with work and all kinds of things. And we all do want to do a better job, I think, and be more successful and enjoy our work more. But we need, I think, I need reminders anyway to do that. I think most people do. And this is a nice, simple way, at least. You can pick out one of 10 things, whether it's listening or involving people in decision-making or just learning more, growing your mind every day, staying in good health. What are you doing? You got to be healthy to be a good manager.
Absolutely.
So anyway, it all ties together, and I always like in my life to integrate my work with my life, because I've only got one to live, and I want it to be good as best I can.
Absolutely. So what is the address of your website? And I assume that's how people can can learn more about and maybe even purchase one or both of your books.
It's just www.robertbezat.com.
And we should probably spell your last name then.
Okay. Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, and Bezat, B-E-E, Z as in zebra, A-T as in Tom.
All right. So robertbizat.com. Very good. And this new book, again, is called Character-Based Management, A Key to More Productive and Effective Organizations, written by Robert Bizat. Robert Bizat, great to meet you and great to talk with you about your interesting book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
It's 8:39, and part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment right here on WGTD. The month of August, of course, is, among other things, the month when most of us, if we are students or teachers, are frantically getting ready for a new school year. And for those who are heading off to college for the first time or heading back to college, it can be an especially frantic, intense time of preparation because there is a lot that goes into college life. And one thing that if you are a parent, that you might want to think about slipping into your child's care package before they head off to college, or if you yourself are a college student and want to have some great ideas about how to keep yourself a little bit better fed than you might otherwise be, is a small book packed with interesting information called Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. Create extraordinary dishes from the ordinary ingredients in your college meal plan. The author of this intriguing book is Priya Krishner, who not long ago graduated from Dartmouth College, where she really devoted quite a lot of her time to the matter of eating well, and in particular of finding creative ways of putting good meals together from what she found in her dining hall. And she not only was busy doing, but also busy writing. She had a weekly column in the school newspaper, contributed to the Small Kitchen College website, wrote a column, and then was an intern at the Food Network. She now works for Lucky Peach, which is a journal devoted to food. And she is going to be joining us on the morning show to talk about this wonderful book, which is published by Story Publishing, again called Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. Priya Krishna, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, and it's great to be talking with you, and I happen to be someone who teaches at a college, so I guess I'm maybe more aware than maybe the typical person is about sometimes the quandaries that face college students in terms of getting themselves well-fed, particularly on what's often a limited budget or within the constraints of a school meal plan. Tell us a little bit about what you experienced as a student at Dartmouth and why you ultimately chose to really devote quite a lot of your energy and intellect to this matter of feeding yourself as well as possible.
I mean, it was kind of a happy accident. I was writing for our school newspaper, and I knew I wanted to write about food. I thought I wanted to write restaurant reviews, but in a place like Hanover, where there are five restaurants, that wasn't really viable. So, you know, I wanted to write about food in a way that was accessible to students. And I had been sort of, I think it was born out of the fact that my parents just didn't really let me near kitchen appliances for a long time. I'd gotten really good at taking, you know, ingredients and combining them into really interesting meals using not a stove or no oven, just, you know, the basics that you had on hand. And so I was sitting and doing it one day, and my sister told me it would make a great column. So I started a column. The column ended up landing me a job as a consultant for our school's dining halls. And that led me to doing a lot of research on like what you find in the average college dining hall. I remember I got to go to these college food conferences and basically interview food providers about what ingredients students really liked, what equipment they had, and all that. And I ended up, you know, condensing it, making 75 recipes, and then turning into the book.
Hmm. In the acknowledgments, you mention both your mother and your father, and you acknowledge their contributions to this book and or to your success in two different ways. If I remember correctly, you call your mother your inspiration, but your dad, you call him more like the architect, I think, or designer or something. Tell us how they each figured in who you are and, in a sense, the expertise you bring to this project.
Yeah, that's a great question. So my mom, like I said, she's this very inspiring woman. She immigrated with my father from India in the 80s. They didn't have a lot of money, and she basically had to learn how to cook and eat in a diverse way and in a healthy way for her and my father, using a very, very limited ingredients that they had access to. And so she basically just taught herself to cook, watching these PBS cooking shows. And I remember growing up, I didn't watch any of the traditional TV shows for kids, but I more watched these cooking shows, and she would put my crib in front of there. And that's, I guess, I was absorbing food at a very young age. And, you know, when I grew up, I remember I would sit on my and do my homework on the counter and watch her cook. So I just have been observing her my whole life. She inspired almost all the recipes in the cookbook. She signed off on all of them. She's really an amazing woman. And my dad is like an engineering background. He's very detail oriented. So when it came time to creating my proposal, sending it, my dad was the one helping me print it and pack it and mail it off. All the logistical details, like the contract, choosing a publisher and all of that, he really helped. And my dad, you know, my dad's an entrepreneur. He started his own business when he was, you know, in his 20s. And I would like to think that I get that spirit from him.
Hmm.
That's what prompted me to, like, madly send 50 book proposals while I was still in college.
I appreciate the fact that you take the time to kind of set the stage in terms of why a book like this could be so very, very helpful to the typical college student. Of course, one thing that a college student can do is just show up at the dining hall and just eat whatever's just sort of right there and settle for that and maybe be content. But, of course, you're thinking that that the typical college student would, in fact, really like to have a more interesting time putting their own meals together or having a hand in it. And yet the constraints of what college life is like, of what the typical college student has on hand, means that they can't think of themselves as chefs the way they might back home. Talk a little more about the constraints of the typical college student and how you've tried to design this book with those constraints in mind.
So, I mean, a college student basically lacks two things, and the first is time, and the second is resources. So what I saw in a lot of the college cookbooks that exist today was basically they didn't really account for these things. They assume that college students have money, which most don't, and that they have the resources to, you know, have access to a nice kitchen, equipment, they cleaning up, doing the dishes, prepping, buying ingredients. And I think no matter how easy a recipe is to cook, you still have to do all of those things. And so then I did research on dining meal plans and discovered that, you know, over half of incoming freshmen are tied to a meal plan when they first come to college. So, you know, I wanted to work within the real life constraints that students have to deal with and, you know, show them how they can take a meal plan, something that people view as boring, but is also mandatory, and make it into something really special.
Mm. You've done a couple things here that make this cookbook unlike your typical cookbook. And one of the things is that these are recipes, look like recipes at a glance, but in fact, the closer we look, the more we realize you've tried to craft these recipes in such a way that they are highly customizable, flexible, because they just really need to be in order for this to serve college students across the country.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think that I did research the ingredients down at most dining halls, but at the end of the day, I wanted to make these recipes as adaptable as possible. So every single one, you can swap out any of the ingredients. You can choose a different protein, choose a different sauce. It's really meant to allow students to take the recipes and adapt them to suit their own tastes and also to suit what's available for them in their respective dining halls. Because obviously I did a lot of research at dining halls, but hard to know it's in every single one.
Right. So these recipes are really designed so if you don't quite have ingredient X, it's something close, and you leave a lot of things, in a sense, open-ended for adjustments to be made in the moment. It really makes a lot of sense. Well, we should talk about a few of the intriguing recipes that are in this book. And among the most intriguing, in my opinion, is the very, very first one, which is in the section devoted to things that people can whip up for breakfast if they don't want to just have the same old tired breakfast fare. The very first recipe is for an apple and cottage cheese breakfast bowl. Mm-hmm. I've never heard or seen anything quite like this, but it looks really cool. Tell our listeners what this looks like and tastes like.
Sure. Interestingly enough, I had never heard of cottage cheese before I went to college, or never seen it or tasted it. I was frankly a little bit scared of it. The texture was weird. It looked kind of weird. But I decided to experiment with it because my dining hall had a lot of it, and a lot of dining halls have a lot of it. So this is really easy. You basically just take cottage cheese, you mix in a sweetener of sorts in it. I like, you know, putting honey or brown sugar. And then you take apples and you coat them with cinnamon and sugar and lemon. And you can either microwave the apples so that they get kind of like more caramelized, or you can just put them as is on top of the cottage cheese. And it's just this really delicious breakfast pudding. It's really good, and it's also very, very healthy, incidentally.
Now, I'm really curious about something like that that really is out of the ordinary. How in the world did you come up with that? I mean, do you happen to recall?
That one, I think that I was watching the Food Network, and I was watching a segment about incorporating cottage cheese into breakfast. They were doing it, I think, with bananas or something. They were like blending together cottage cheese and bananas. And I thought it would be really, I love apples and cinnamon. It's like, you know, a very classic combination. So I thought, what if we did apple cinnamon on top of cottage cheese? So I gave it a whirl in the dining hall and it tasted really good.
Mm. You have a relatively small section of devoted to salads, but several of them sound really, really good, especially the BLT chopped salad. You say this is maybe one of those relatively rare instances in which a salad really, in and of itself, can be a very, very satisfying meal. I mean, even for the typically hungry college student.
Yeah, exactly. I think that I have a weird vendetta against salads because I eat one because I'm trying to be healthy and I'm never quite full and still end up eating like another meal. So I included a few salad recipes, in the hopes that these ones are actually filling. And the BLT chopped salad, I think, because it has so many filling ingredients, like it's got a little bit of bacon, it's got corn, feta, avocado. It's something that'll actually fill you up.
Mm. You have in the section devoted to sandwiches, not only a little guide to whipping up your own sloppy joes, even a day when that's not exactly what's being served in the dining hall. And you also have an idea for dressing up the hamburgers, the plain Jane hamburgers that might be served in a dining hall. Explain to our listeners a couple of your most basic yet valuable ideas about this.
I mean, I think a really great tip just in general, but that applies really well for burgers, is take combinations that you love and apply it in new settings. So for a burger, for example, I love caprese salads. I love the combination of tomatoes, mozzarella, balsamic, and even a little bit of basil. So one of them is a caprese burger. Same thing with Asian stir fries. I love chili sauce and, like, you know, fried egg. So put a fried egg and chili sauce on your burger. And then I'm from Texas. We live off of a diet of chips, salsa, and queso. So I had to put a burger in there that consisted of cheddar cheese salsa and crushed tortilla chips, and that's really, really good.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of recipes that we look at and immediately think, yes, that sounds fabulous. And then there are a few things here that where it might take a little courage for us to try them. For instance, in the sandwich section, you have a recipe for a grilled jam and cheese sandwich. And just at a glance, that does not look too promising. But actually, I read this recipe, and I really want to try this. Explain to our listeners what this exactly is.
I mean, think of it as a scone with strawberry jam and clotted cream in a panini, or like a strawberry shortcake in a panini. Basically, you take bread, you put cream cheese on one side, strawberry jam on the other side, you kind of butter both ends, and then you press it in the panini press, and it comes out, and it's just this, I mean, we made this the other day at an event, and it's just sort of buttery, creamy, strawberry. It just is like this burst of jammy goodness. It's so good. One of my favorite sandwich recipes that also can double as a dessert recipe. I think it's more like a dessert, but it's really good.
I am really glad that, and it makes a whole lot of sense that maybe the biggest section of the book is the one devoted to snacks. Not a big surprise when you're trying to cater to college students. And there's all kinds of things in here that I find really intriguing, and as also in the dessert section. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was something called carrot cake dip.
Carrot cake dip,
You point out the fact that it's not likely that most college students will have what they need in order to whip up their own carrot cake. But evidently, you think it wouldn't be too big a deal to whip up carrot cake dip.
No, I think that carrot cake dip, all of the components you can find in a dining hall. And for me, that's, you know, obviously carrots, cinnamon, sugar, raisins. Usually my favorite carrot cakes have a little bit of orange peel in them. So you put a little bit of orange juice. And it's just a dip that you can kind of spread over cookies. And a cookie, I found, forms a really good like cake base. And so when you bite it all together, it really tastes like you're getting like cake plus frosting. And then you get that like carrot-y flavor with the sweetness of the yogurt and the sugar. And you get complexity because you've got raisins, you've got orange flavor, you've got cinnamon. This is a really cool recipe. It's definitely one of the more creative out-of-the-box desserts.
You share thoughts on how to make great milkshakes, a wonderful thing called banana boats in which you're eating your banana and other delicious things right out of the peel. Helpful hints on making great snow cones. And you even point out, and I appreciate the fact, that it's pronounced bruschetta, not bruschetta. And someone who teaches vocal diction to singers, this is a little cause of mine, and I'm glad to see that you point this out and share a really good recipe for bruschetta while you're at it. It's a great book. In our closing minute or so, is there a favorite recipe of yours you feel like you want to mention to our listeners?
My all-time favorite recipes that I still make is for the bread pudding. There's an apple cinnamon bread pudding in here. It's really easy. You just take a piece of bread, put it in a bowl, break it up, add some milk or vanilla soy milk, some honey, some cinnamon, a few spoons of applesauce, microwave that until the milk kind of soaks into the bread and gets hot and delicious. And then you add a scoop of ice cream and it tastes like it just came out of the oven. It's really, really good. Maybe a drizzle of honey on top.
This and many other wonderful recipes are in this book called Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. Create extraordinary dishes from the ordinary ingredients in your college meal plan. And, it's published by Story, and this book, although it's modestly sized, is packed with wonderful, helpful information for the typical college student wanting to spice up their culinary life. And the author, Priya Krishna. Priya Krishna, I appreciate this opportunity to talk with you about this wonderful book, and I'm glad you created it. I have a feeling college students across the country will enjoy having it and making use of it, and I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I will be speaking with Kyle Schwartz, who is a public school teacher and the author of an extraordinarily inspiring book called I Wish My Teacher Knew. That's coming up on tomorrow's morning show. On Thursday, Professor Jonathan Shaler from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, analyzing the rhetoric which is being exchanged in the current presidential campaign. The morning show is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening.